Sympathy for the Racist, Learning How, Not What, to Think, In Favor of Price Gouging and Dismantling Unions, and Saying Goodbye to an Old Friend. I'm Justin Katz, and this is Last Impressions 30. So here we go with another school year. It's a 4-day week. Kids back to school. Children are reaching that age where a lot of sports and practices and events and things to do. It's very tiring. I didn't get much sleep, and I'm recording this much later. It's nighttime as I record, so we'll see how it goes. Maybe we'll find out it'll be better. Maybe that's the secret will be sleep deprivation. Maybe if I were a little more tired, I'd be using a sleep depravity, which might point in a different direction. But anyway, so this week, I was listening to Kevin Williamson on Mad Dogs and Englishmen. It's a podcast available via Ricochet. And he had done for National Review magazine an interview with Richard Spencer. Now, Richard Spencer is, in many ways, I think you could say he's responsible for ensuring that the alt-right went in the racist direction that it did. I've mentioned this before. When it was first a topic of conversation, the alt-right was pretty broadly encompassing. I toyed with thinking of myself as alt-right a year or so ago. It's just, you know, it was kind of a younger, more savvy, a little bit tougher, rhetorically tougher, I guess you would say, version of the right. And the news media tried to push the element of this that was racist, and that started to stick. And I know a lot of people on the right, conservatives, who got the alt-right hate mail always had that association. But from just an observer's point of view, it always seemed like a broader movement. And at some point, more and more people who didn't have that racist element started to back off of it and stop identifying as alt-right, which left it to the racist. So now that's what was said a year ago is seems to be pretty accurate description now. And Richard Spencer had a good bit to do with that. So Kevin Williamson is looking into this phenomenon and interviewed Richard Spencer. And I thought this clip from Mad Dogs and Englishmen was very, very interesting and points to an important lesson.
And it was really disturbing for me in the course of the conversation because, you know, if he were a different person with different views about race, if he weren't captive to these insane and wicked and crazy ideas, he's very much like someone who could be, you know, someone I would know. He's very, you know, culturally, I guess, familiar in a lot of ways. He is someone who feels like he comes from the same kind of world.
Now, when Williamson says that, he's not just talking about the fact that he and Spencer are both kind of conservative, but also, I guess, they're both, you know, theater nerds, culturally higher end, perhaps you might say. And that makes him uncomfortable, that this guy feels familiar to him, almost a there, but by the grace of good sense, go I. And that kind of bothers me. I think we ought to me, that familiarity is ultimately a good thing. I mean, unless you're insecure, and I don't think Williamson is in any regard, but unless you're insecure about your non-racism or your tolerance or sense of good will toward man, it's a good thing to have that familiarity and that connection because it means there should be a way that you can help that person find a way back or find the path back, even if that it's too late for that person. I think some of what Williamson is talking about here, or this inclination, is this: we seem to have this bizarre notion that the allure of evil is just so enticing that it's almost like a highly contagious and incurable disease. And you got a lot of that coverage from the mainstream news media after Charlottesville. This sense that, ooh, if we let the racists out of their box, white people across America will join them, you know, because we're just going to catch this disease. And you it's just a very dangerous attitude, because you need to be able to, you don't want to convey the sense to people, especially younger people or people who are, I guess, ideologically vulnerable to this message. You don't want to convey the notion that you're afraid of it because it's powerful, because if it's powerful and you can't argue against it, then that's a problem. Then that's a signal to somebody who's attracted by it that it's probably correct, and it's not. So that commonality ought to be a way to connect and to draw back from that idea. I mean, it's almost, you know, the cliche for hate speech and free speech is, you know, the cure, the answer to hate speech isn't censorship, it's more speech. And you speak and you encourage racists to speak, so, you know, in some sense they'll self-identify. And not only is that good because it tells us who they are, and then if we draw out their views, we can start to distinguish between somebody who is racist and somebody who is actually believes that affirmative action, for example, is a bad policy for minorities and for society as a whole. You can start to make those distinctions if people are actually talking. You can't make those distinctions if people aren't talking and articulating their views. And so it's seeming more and more that the left and the mainstream media wants that to be the case, that we can't make these distinctions, so you can easily tar racists with non-racists who share some of the policy views in common. But the other reason you want people to talk about their erroneous ideas is so you can try to persuade them. And even if that person, even if Richard Spencer or whomever is a lost cause or is too heavily invested financially in their personal views, somebody else listening might catch on, might, if they're on the fence, they might hear, they might say, hey, I'm a theater nerd who's inclined toward white supremacy. Maybe I'll follow Richard Spencer. And then you hear him talking with Kevin Williamson and go, oh, well, no, actually that guy's got a good point. I won't become the racist now. That's why we need people to feel comfortable being honest about their views. Taboos and things you can't talk about are very dangerous. Another Ricochet podcast I listened to this week, Bill Bennett, who's been around a long time, you know, cultural commentator, worked in the Reagan White House. He has a new podcast on Ricochet, and he was talking to University of Pennsylvania law professor Amy Wax, who has been on the firing line. Because she wrote an op-ed, and get this, it's amazing, but she's in favor of traditional values. Ooh, terrible, terrible person. So she's been on the firing line on campus, and she's talking about how badly colleges are now serving their students. Take a listen to this.
See, I just see this as a complete betrayal of what the academy is supposed to be. And that's the sad part. I think the university has become a place that teaches students what to think, not how to think. It doesn't inform them about the different arguments on different sides. They don't even know the materials.
I'd go a little bit slightly different direction. Universities not only are teaching what to think instead of how to think, they're also, in lieu of teaching how to think, what I mean, one of the reasons you want to be familiar with material is so you can rebut it, right? It's not scary. It's not, and you don't give it power, like this mysterious power of the forbidden information. So that's one of the reasons you give people that information. But in lieu of that, I think universities teach a kind of almost like tricks to have a rhetorical trick to get out of having to actually engage an idea. And that gets caught up a lot in a PC thing, in the accusations about microaggressions. If you can identify something as a microaggression or a cultural appropriation, you don't have to address it. So these are intellectual tricks to get out of actually having to address ideas. In this case, Professor Wax talks about how she's had students thank her for assigning the book, the Charles Murray's book, The Bell Curve, about differences in IQ across demographics and the implications of that. And she's had, so the students thank her and say, I would never have come across this. There's a lot of good information in this. Whether you agree or disagree, it's good information you'll have to process in order to come to a reasonable conclusion. And that's something that I'm finding is maybe it's always been the case, and maybe social media just makes it possible for people to argue with each other outside of a sort of social sphere. So people who follow me on Twitter or have friended me on Facebook or just keep track of me because they're local activists and don't like me at all, that they may not be very familiar with economic principles, say. And so they'll object to something you say, and when you point out the economic principle, and they become erratic or agitated because it just doesn't make any sense to them. So maybe part of it is just that social media is opening up the connections to people, which could be good if we can have patience and argue across those lines. But one of them the other day, I got into a little bit of a Twitter argument, which is, if you try to invent a medium in which to have a high themed discussions, Twitter is not it. But somehow that's where a lot of these arguments seem to take place. It was this woman locally here in Tiverton who really, really does not like me. In fact, sometimes she'll just, if I'm online and having some kind of a back and forth with somebody in the news media, she'll jump on to tell them how terrible I am. So she couldn't fathom, somebody had commented about price gouging in the airlines in Florida with Hurricane Irma coming and how the tickets of prices were jumping up and how wrong it was. And I replied, in Twitter fashion, no, nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wicked. Price is just a signal. And you don't want to stop that signal from expressing the value of a ticket at an airport. So she just couldn't believe I would defend price gouging. I can sympathize with the response that I get from people like that, because if you don't understand the concept of prices just being a signal of value, and it seems wrong that airlines or gas stations or whatever are bumping up their prices when they know people are desperate, it just seems inexplicable. So somebody saying no, price gouging is good is she said it's like calling the sky green. It just makes no sense. And why would you do that? And clearly she knows me well enough, I think, to know I'm not insane as in schizophrenic. So you must have just either you're bribed or you're serving some your corporate masters or you're really evil and this is you're just trying to rationalize your evil. So I can sympathize with that, but I just wish you could get people to think a bit. I mean, so the analogy I was thinking of, or the scenario, anecdote, whatever, however you want to put it, is if you have so you have this airport. And imagine they raise their tickets out of Florida from $100 to $1,000. Now you've got a rich person who lives a 45-minute drive north of the airport, compared with a poorer person, a working class person, who's 45 minutes south of the airport. So it's right in between them. Now the person in north has a 15% chance, say, of being hit by a hurricane, while the person in the south has an 85% chance of being hit by the hurricane. Now the rich person can afford this ticket at any price, but the higher price forces him to evaluate its worth, right? Maybe it doesn't even have to be necessarily a rich person. Maybe it's somebody a similar working class, middle class person, but they could go an hour and 15 minutes north and catch a flight out of a different airport. So now the price of the ticket at the centrally located one goes up from $100 to $1,000. Now that working class person is a lot of money to them. Yeah, but they need that ticket. The person to the north of the airport doesn't need that ticket. So if they as much, so that $1,000 to save the $900, they'll drive in the other direction, right? It'll change the incentives. Or maybe if it is a rich person, maybe a private plane would be $1,500 instead of the $1,000. So now, before they were comparing $100 to $1,500, and now they're comparing $1,000 to $1,500. So maybe, for the additional convenience of the private jet, they'll go with the extra, more expensive option. And then, you know, in 140 characters, I tried to explain that higher prices will bring more supply. So, you know, maybe the rich person will use a private plane to fly other people out and charge some money for that. It's an incentive. Or maybe airlines will switch things around to get more planes there, to get more people out, because it's worth it. Even if they have to fly an empty jet, if they can get across the country to get it there, that's worth it if they can charge 3, 4, 5, 6 times the price. Now, the moral component here is important, too, of course. So, I mean, of course, we should consider other people in our decisions, regardless of the price. I mean, if you don't need to get out and you know other people do, whether the price is a lot or a little, you know, don't take the plane. You know, if you've got a well and there's bottled water available and you know other people need that water, you know, let them get it. Whatever, even if it's not $40 a bottle, you know, just so. Yeah, we should speak out, you know, morally, not legally, against real price gouging, which is, or maybe we need to add an adjective. So immoral price gouging, or maybe the distinction is gouging versus, you know, price adjusting. So, you know, if a seller knows a particular person is in a hardship individually and takes advantage of that person, now that's wrong. I mean, if you've got, I don't know, say a car rental office and you've got plenty of cars in a lot and some person runs up desperate to get to an injured child who's been taken to the hospital, that's not a broad circumstance that indicates big demands and justifies adjusting your price. It's just a single person needing a car like any other single person might need a car. So, you know, it would be wrong to make that person suffer because they're desperate. That would be wrong. But, you know, price is part of any moral calculation, and changing prices helps. As I said, prices, it's just a signal. You know, it lets you know what the value of that particular item is at that time and place. And that's good. You want people to be able to make decisions around that value. It's not just a matter of forcing a decision on somebody. I mean, it's not, what I mean by that is not, it's not, we don't want the prices to go up to force the rich person not to get the ticket, but it's a signal to each other. So to people, this is the value of this ticket. If it's not worth it to you, let somebody else get it because it's valuable to them. I think some people, I'm doing a lot of explaining here and probably my tiredness is showing, but I think some people just don't like that the airline company gets to keep the extra money. You know, that's wrong, it seems like. But, you know, that's how these things work. And in the long run, that too is good. I mean, if for example, the airlines know that they'll be able to charge extra during catastrophes that are, say, common to an area, a lot of hurricanes in Florida, maybe they'll even take a loss for much of the time in order to be able to be well situated when that opportunity arises to make up killing. That's a bad choice of words, but to make a lot of money. So that's enough on price gouging. I think people need to, we need to do better job of educating people. One of my daughter's schools just started an economics course, and I'm going to make her take it because I think it's very important to understand, have a passing familiarity with these concepts so they don't seem like this bizarre, the sky is green kind of conversation. So on another topic, again on Ricochet, they've got a lot of good podcasts there, so I guess I get a lot of material through that. But the Manhattan Institute scholar Orrin Cass was on the City Journal podcast, and he was making a lot of interesting points about the failures of unions and their inability to attract new workforces. There's a Volkswagen, I think, manufacturer in the United States, or plant in the United States, and the union has been trying to unionize them, and the people keep saying no. So he's pointing out that maybe people are now figuring out that the unions aren't going to do all that much additional for them for a variety of reasons, both regulations and they see how other companies have gone out of business or had to lay people off. So, you know, I would say that's actually a sign of how good and great the internet is, and to some extent conservative media, bringing people can now trace these things much better than it could at one point. They can follow along, and if their choice decision to whether to, or not to join a union comes before them, they can Google the unions and whether it's worth it, and they can get both sides. Hey, there's that concept again, both sides, and make an intelligent decision. So here's Orrin Kass.
And so as people have seen that unions don't deliver the goods, while they do set up very adversarial relationships with management, while they do collect union dues that are a significant chunk of paychecks, especially for working class households, it doesn't turn out to be such a good bargain.
So the point is, people can see and make an informed decision. He also mentions things like unions are becoming political organizations, getting involved in political issues, and that don't necessarily reflect the views of their workers, and that is a disincentive to join them. In that regard, I wonder if part of the issue is that the face of labor unions has become public sector unions, and they're much more politically visible. It's not just after union privileges. It's the NEA in Rhode Island, at least, and I imagine nationally, is really a progressive activist group that uses the taxpayer-funded dues to lobby for left-wing causes. And if you don't agree with that, and that's the face of unions, then maybe when you're asked in your private sector job if you want to join a union, you'll have some resistance to that. But, you know, also, the world's just changing. We don't really need unions as they were once structured. I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean that there aren't things that would help workers, benefits, maybe Kass suggests things, calls them co-ops, whatever you want to call them, but ways to get benefits, ways to push industry-wide for particular reforms or ways things people do just to represent workers. Those things mostly require us to begin reforming the laws that give unions such a structural advantage. So either way, we need to get out of that. So I'm drifting off because I think I've been resisting the last topic here. I just found out on Facebook yesterday, an old friend of mine, I haven't seen him in a long time, Jeff, I'm not going to give his last name because I'm told he got to be a very private person about his illness, which, the fact that I didn't hear about it. I found out that he died last December after some, I guess he was fighting cancer and it made a comeback. He would have been around 41 or 42. I only know it because the folks, this year across Facebook, I've been noticing it's become a thing to post old back to school photos. And a mutual friend posted a picture of the two of them going to kindergarten. But what's striking is, I haven't spoken with Jeff probably since high school. So we're going on 25 years now. But it's interesting, I wonder if this is a technological thing. We have a unique connection, I think, with people with whom we grew up and went to grade school, high school with. An extended family relationship. And I what I'm curious about, and I haven't seen much rumination on the topic, is I wonder if the internet helps us keep this feeling. Because we've got the ability now to check in from time to time on people. And in the past, maybe that was letters, from your family about people that they knew you were close with, that they were close with or could keep tabs on, or you were in touch with mutual friends. And so you got that kind of a connection to hear about how people are doing. But now we can maintain that sense of connection on a much broader scale, and I wonder if that's kind of a unique, forming a unique sense among people of my generation and younger, being able to keep up with your high school friends and in at least a cursory regard, like you would keep up with a cousin or something that you don't often see. Or maybe I'm just sappy, but anyway, yeah. Jeff's defining characteristic was just this huge smile, always affable. I forget which class year it was. I want to say it had to be senior year, just the nature of the the content. But Jeff and I and our friend Andrew, who incidentally, I believe, interned in the Clinton White House, so I haven't heard much from him in some years. We managed to be assigned as a group for various different projects, and I think in multiple classes, and we just worked it out that we were a three-person team. And so we divided up the work, and there were some projects, I don't even recall what they were, because I don't know if the statute of limitations on cheating is still applicable, but I didn't do much of the work. But the main thing I did was I wrote a spoof version of Romeo and Juliet, and then the three of us, using multiple masks because we couldn't break it up, that we all each had, sometimes we all had to play the same character at some point. But so we all acted out, and Jeff and Andrew did most of the production on, you know, VHS, which is, if you don't recall, were these old tapes with a black strip that went through, and that was your video. And it wasn't quite as easy to edit as you get now on digital software. But anyway, filming that show, it was just a great experience. And, you know, I was just very fortunate to have had that time to get to know Jeff pretty well. And, you know, I'm just sorry I won't be able to check in from time to time and see how his smile has aged. But on that happy note, I am now, this is now on iTunes. I'll put a link to the feed on the post on theoceanstatecurrent.com. I hear it's very important for people to go on there and give reviews to podcasts, especially if they're good reviews. So please, you know, if you like what you hear, go ahead and do that. And in the meantime, enjoy that back to school week. You know, catch up on your sleep, maybe heading into week number 2 or 3 or 1, if that's the case for you. See you later.